the deal is, Randy and I like to get around and talk about old racing, our heroes, you know, and we enjoy talking about the old days, and we think, well, that's when racing was racing, wasn't it, Randy?
It was, and we're lucky that we had a couple of heroes in the house, mm-hmm. so it makes it a lot easier for us to do it. It means a lot that your dad, my dad, and uncle, and all the folks from back in the day did what they did. It makes it easy for us to sit down and reminisce and move forward with what we do. We have a good time with what we're doing today.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I mean, they didn't realize that they were part of history, or going to be, and certainly we never give it a thought, but that's where it comes into being, our heroes. And, you know, back in those days, be Western Cowboys and the race car drivers. That's all I had to look up to. And much different today. But I certainly remember Billy Myers and his brother Bobby. And I told you one time I got to ride. That's the first time I ever towed a race car was your daddy. And he'd never.
I remember the story.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I could have killed both of them. Let me change plugs in his car. He'd get me two hot dogs and a coat.
Well, those were the days that, you know, boys was boys and men was men. Mm-hmm. And you know, the men let the boys play a lot, mm-hmm. too. And that was, you know, I was 10 when Daddy died. So I remember some stuff. I remember hanging around his garage over on Walktown Street and getting to paint the tires and, you know, sweeping the floors and stuff like that. But it was growing up around the shop and over at the stadium, it was just a way of life.
Yeah, and that's where, basically, I guess that's where I remember Billy from was Bowman Gray Stadium. And I know my daddy, you know, my daddy ran the first race over at the stadium.
Right.
And at one time, Sam Rice had bought a Ford, his old Curtis Turner Ford, and my daddy was going to drive it, but he had that truck and he had to go north, and they got Billy to drive it and run down Columbia, South Carolina. Number 26.
Right.
But, yeah, they knew one another. But Billy, you know, when I think about Bowman Gray Stadium, I think about Billy and Bobby Myers. And that car that Billy had, you might know something about it, that Arnold Charles had ground the cam in it and had that funny nose.
I don't remember that much about the car itself, but I remember the 402 Junior deal. Now, that was the camshaft or the grind on the camshaft that Arnold said was the thing, and evidently it was for a couple of years because he was hard to beat at the stadium or anywhere for a couple of years with that stuff.
It just putted around. I mean, the motor didn't sound like it's turning any RPMs, but the car was out front, everybody trying to catch him.
Yeah, the Charles Cam and the Fish carburetor, that was that was a big thing. And he had a trick fuel too. And, yeah, it was 3-2-S-O. I guess that was SO.
Yeah.
But that was supposed to be the trick. But I think he was actually running an SO station over on, I guess, it was on 4th Street in Weston. So I remember going there as a kid watching the Christmas parades.
Yeah. You talking about the garage. That's the one on Walltown, but it's right there at Old Salem, down there in the bottom. Is that the one you're talking about?
It's down in the hole. It's where McLean Trucking Company is now.
I've been there many times getting parts.
I did that. I remember that shop. I remember the shop over on Indiana Avenue that he got when he started the factory stuff or the mercury stuff. And, you know, that was actually Red Stoltz wound up with that shop. Still there. Some Hispanic guys have got a cleanup shop in it. It looks a little different, but it's still there. But it's, you know, I remember a lot of things. And as I told you before, a lot of the stories I remember because I've been told the stories over and over and over and over again. In my mind, I see, I remember being there the night that Daddy died at the stadium. I remember in my mind him rolling up, waving at me and Garrett in the grandstands. I have not a clue if it's the truth, but if it really happened, but I remember that. And I remember the car kind of bumping over the guardrail down in turn four and landed in the bushes. But I guess the thing I remember most is Whitey Norman came by and picked up myself and Gary, took us over to old City Hospital. That's where they took Danny that night. And, we sat there in Whitey's old 44 that I guess he still owns.
Mm-hmm.
Those were good days, and of course those were bad days as well. But history's made up of those things, and you got to do what you got to do and live with those things and go down the road. And you know, I'm just glad we got people. your age and my age and a little bit behind us that still care enough about the sport to be able to do the things that we get to do now. That's a lot to me. So.
How did the Myers Brother Award come into being?
You know,
I know it's honoring them, but...
I really can't tell you how it actually got started.
It's one of the first, though, isn't it?
It was the first that actually at the time it was the Southern Motorsports Press Association, and Hank Schoolfield was involved in that, and Hank worked towards getting that award established through them, and of course it's evolved over the years and gone through from the NMPA deal, which they still sponsor the award or do the award, but NASCAR does the thing that they do now. Of course it got a little bit bigger as it went along. And Hank was real instrumental in getting Daddy inducted into the NMPA Hall of Fame at Darlington. And I think that was 66, maybe. I was working for Huggins, the Goodyear distributor at the time. But I think Hank was real instrumental in that. And, you know, he and Daddy were real close. So that meant a lot to continue that. This is, I guess, 4 years now that they've done it, and I'm assuming Bert and Jason will go to Vegas this year. I'm not going, I don't guess this year, but it's they've been keeping presents for the family to show. We used to, Gary and I used to go to New York when they did it at the Waldorf at the Starlight Roof, and then they moved, I guess, a little bit later on to a satellite location up there. I can't remember where it was, but it was.
He was, what, 56 National Sportsman Champion?
55. He won 48 races that year.
Is that his car he's driving?
His car nearly every time. Earlier in his career, he had to, he'd lose a car or break something and have to swap around with some other folks. He drove for, drove some for E.H. Weddle, drove right much for Calvin Wooten.
Had some nice cars, didn't he, Calvin?
Calvin had some outstanding race cars, and drove some for J.S. Pope from over to, in Winston-Salem, Pope Sam Company. So he drove a lot of cars, but in 54, I guess, and 55, Woody Hooser was kind of his co-owner in the deal, and it worked out to... He just had everything clicked. Somebody, once in a while, he hit those years and everything clicked in 55 and he won all the races.
You think maybe that's what landed him the first Mercury deal? France probably maybe suggested or how
France,
that came
in. I'm sure was instrumental in doing it. Bill Sr. was, he was pretty much a visionary. About to get off stage, kind of a lot different from what it is today. But, Bill Sr. was real instrumental in getting a lot of things done for a lot of people.
I think he got the Petty's, the Oldsmobile deal, too.
He got that done. And, getting those people, getting those things done for people like Matt and Lee and everybody that was involved in the sport in those days, it helped him in the long run. So it was in his best interest to do those things. Yeah. So, why not do it? As long as he could advance the NASCAR standing and those kinds of things, it worked out great for everybody concerned. But I like to think those 48 races had a bearing on what Stripe decided to do.
Yeah.
I won't swear to it, but I think that record still stands as far as NASCAR's sanctioned races, 48 in a year. I think it still stands.
Yeah.
So.
Well, when I think of Billy, of course Bobby too, I always think of Bowling Green Stadium.
Sure.
And you've heard over the years, or back in our days, the house that Babe Ruth built. And I think of the stadium as the stadium or the house that the Myers brothers built. And I guess there were some pretty good rivalries over there. They were good friends. But do you remember much about did Bobby and Billy ever get into it?
They got into it probably as much with one another as they did with other people on their own. I remember one year, and it could have been the 55 season, but it was – 53 or 4 or 5, somewhere along there, that Bobby had, was always into it with Turner about something. And then, of course, Daddy gets sucked in, and Glenn Wood got sucked into it because he was a Virginia guy. And, you get Glenn to tell the story, he said, I just don't know why they got me involved in that because I never was in a fight with them. But they had a burying a hatchet deal over there. They took a little box of sand and buried four little tiny rubber hatchets in it, you know, and got everybody kissing makeup. But there was a lot of rivalries. And, you know, the stadium was one of those places that sometimes you go to a fight and a race would break out. And, it was a lot of that. And, of course, it's still that way today to a degree. And I know that there's a lot of rivalries that have carried on over the years. You know, back in the day, Ebb Clifton was always at the stadium and providing cars and drove cars and had drivers that drove his stuff. And
I believe Fuzzy was the better
Fuzzy
good
was
driver.
Probably
yeah.
The better of the racers, probably so, but Ebb was pretty
good.
He
did too, yeah.
And
he knew them old flathead folks.
He absolutely, and still does, and still does. So, you know, that rivalry even carried down from M. Clifton to his grandson, Tim Brown, who's my nephew's Bert and Jason's one of their key competitors at the stadium. So, you know, things don't ever change over there.
But there's been so many good drivers there.
Oh,
I mean,
everybody's been through there.
You know, today, not many people sat around and said, well, I saw Fonnie Flock race, but I did.
Yeah.
I got some. He won the first race over there, didn't he?
Right, sure did.
But, I mean, you had Flock. I guess Tim probably raced over because he moved to Winston one time.
Well, they all raced there to a degree, but
I don't
Bonnie
think Bob did.
Bob,
but,
you're right, Bob did.
But you know, you had Ted Swain, Perk Brown,
yep.
Of course Turner,
Pee Wee Jones,
yep. E.H. Weddle,
yep.
Whitey Norman, Ken Rush, Hill McKilliver.
On and on.
Those guys.
Pascal, yeah.
Yeah, Pascal come over there one time. Never driven this car, but Ken had qualified on the pole. I don't know whose car it was, but it had a big Ford engine in it, and it was a bear to drive. Others had tried it, but Ken could manhandle it. You know, Ken was a pushed out guy.
He was, yeah.
But he said on the pole, but it rained it out or something, and he had a race to go to at Myrtle Beach. So he called Pascal up, well, no, will you come over and drive that car? I'm going to Myrtle Beach. And Jim said, yep. So Jim went over there and never sat down in that car, and he got ready to start the race. He'd already been qualified. They left it on the pole. He gets in it, never made a lap around there except the pace lap, and they threw the flag. He left them. And I don't know how long of a race it was, 100 laps or 99 laps or what, but he led every lap and won the race with it and had never sat down in that car.
Pascal was, he was a wheel man. That's the only way to describe him. He was probably one of the most underrated or overlooked racers that ever drove in any of the NASCAR stuff.
He never seeked any publicity or recognition.
He was just so quiet and calm, and you know, like, he talked. He was something else. I was at Wilsonburg the day that he knocked that Pontiac out from one of them two women on the back stretch.
Somebody left the gate open or something.
Yeah, left the gate. The short arm left the gate open and let him in. And he came out to qualify and just left him sitting in the middle of the racetrack. Knocked the car right out.
You was working with Huggins then?
I was working with Huggins, yeah. Sure.
But, you
Jim,
know,
kind of, Jim and Darrell Derringer kind of took me under their wing, kept me out of trouble. So.
You know, Jim's car, I guess in 57, might have been one of the first cars that Derringer, I know he drove one of, that's where I met Darrell, was over at Jim's garage. I was working for Jim. And Jim, so he had those two Mercurys, so he let Darrell drive one of them. And then, of course, Darrell went on later on, but more different places.
Yeah, Darrell's first, I guess, first Grand National stuff he drove was for John. He drove for John Zink.
Okay, he was here in
53, 4, 5, 6. Somewhere along there, yeah. And, Darrell, like I said, Darrell and Jim kind of kept me out of trouble when I worked for him. So I was just 18, 19 years old, and I was pretty rambunctious. And, They kicked me out.
I know Derringer a lot of fun to be around.
He was a lot of fun.
Do you ever run across any of the guys, their sons or any of them that might still be living, like Swain and Park Brown, any of them?
No, I don't. I probably don't go as much into the in the neighborhood as I used to go, and I don't see very many of them. Perk Jr., or Little Perk, or whatever they want to call him, he still lives up around Eden as far as I know. He tried to be a race car driver at one time, but I don't know if he just didn't have a desire or the talent or one or the other, but he didn't stick around very long. But
You know, Randy, they had this madhouse over at the stadium here a few years back.
Yeah.
And they had a lot of that was staged, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah,
but you know, I want to tell you, when your daddy and Bobby, Perk Brown, Jimmy Lou Allen, and Turner, they didn't have to stage nothing.
No, it was.
If they could have filmed all that then,
there's no telling. It would have changed the world as far as racing.
And think about this, see if you agree with me. That was the mistake of that stadium. That's why people wanted to come back the next Saturday night to see what's going to happen next. It was like a opera of some type, wasn't it? Because
it was a soap opera or a circus or I've heard it called everything that you could think of. Some of them not so nice, but it's the thing about the stadium is everybody's right on top of the action. Grandstands are right on top of the racetrack. There's nothing to obstruct your view. And, you know, if you wanted to look into the pits, you could always go down to the end of the grandstands on either end of the horseshoe and look down there and see what's going on in the pits. And so a lot of what started on the racetrack carried over to the pits, and people were able to see it. And then it's the only track that I can think of that when the race is over will have 1,500 or more people in the pits walk around talking to their buddies and looking at their heroes or their favorite drivers and getting autographs and stuff like that. It's the only track I know of for whatever reason. It's always been
that way. They had their group of fans that supported the drivers. But, man, I tell you, always the paper, the High Point Enterprise, Greensboro Daily News, they'd have what's happening up there. And I think that's why people came back every Saturday to see a continuation of the rivalry, the fist fights. What about the picture up there that shows Fred Harp sitting up on the wall?
Up on the wall,
with his helmet in his hand.
Yeah.
Down below him is his tore up race car, and then Ken Rush's race car is torn up, and Fred on both of them.
Yeah.
And some guy wrecked them. And rather than getting in the fight, Fred hops up on the rail to watch him, and Ken goes down and whips the guy's butt, you know.
Yeah. Fred had the helmet at the ready, though.
Yes.
It was going to go. But, you know, I can remember I found a 56 marker sitting on the side of 58 up in Danville one time, outside of Cleaners. And I stopped to try to get the guy to, you know, would you sell it if I did this or whatever. Anyway, and there's a sticker in the windshield, Bowman Gray Stadium sticker in the corner of the window on it. So, you know, people came and still do from that area. It's a cult following, I guess, to some degree. And you know, I told you earlier, I sold soda pop, and I remember that. And if the folks I sold drinks to when I was 12, 13 years old, if they're not dead, I could probably sell them a drink tomorrow. So,
did you ever figure up how many races your daddy won over at the stadium?
He only won 22 at the stadium, but he only ran over there from 50 through 55 on a regular basis. And actually one season he didn't run in there because of suspension from NASCAR. I still got the telegram that Pat Purcell sent him that you are hereby indefinitely suspended from NASCAR for conduct detrimental. He got into it with Jack Holloway. Got into it with him. Holloway turned him around, he thought, at the end of a race. And so,
did that happen at the stadium?
It happened at the stadium, and Daddy went up, rolled up behind him after the race was over on the start and finish line, and tagged him in the rear bumper sitting on the start and finish line. And they thought that wasn't good because it stirred up a big fight. And, you know, they got in the grandstands, people in the grandstands fussing and carrying on.
They egged it on, didn't they?
Yeah, so that's, but they suspended him. So he spent most of 1954. I can't remember which. He spent most of one of those seasons racing at unsanctioned tracks.
Well, I don't think at that point in time you really had somebody that would dominate from year to year over there. Because I've told before that as far as having parity, that in that period of time, it was the driver. The cars were about the same because you didn't have all the speed equipment and stuff.
That's true.
And you didn't have engineers and 40 people working on this car. Your deal started at a junkyard somewhere, or a friend that had what you needed, and you bought it, carried it home, made a race car out of it.
And at that time, the season at the stadium was longer than it is now.
Right.
And they didn't run twin races except for once in a while they would run them as a special event. But most of the races were 35 lappers, and if you qualified on the pole, they inverted the field, especially the last year that Daddy was there, or the year they won so many races. He started at the back of the pack nearly every week because they put the fastest qualifier, their handicap system put the quick qualifiers and race winners at the back. Mm-hmm. And so it was tough to win, but there were so many guys there that could win races that if you won five or six in a year, you had a tremendous year because yeah. Turner was there and Glenn and Fonny and all of that group. And
even some Yankees, they, even oh, some Yankees yeah. come down here
they
to try to outrun.
Come down and it was,
and you know, they brought a lot of junk down here that run good.
Yeah.
And they brought some stuff that the guys down here picked up on and actually helped them. I mean, sure. Those guys up there are pretty savvy too. Your daddy went to running the Grand National in 56 and 57. What brought him back to the stadium?
Well, you know, he had run maybe 12 or 15 races through the years. He ran a couple of races for Hawkins, and he drove several races for Hubert Westmoreland. So he had some starts in it, but after the Mercury deal came to pass, you know, the factories were getting a lot of flack in 57 from the insurance companies
yep.
over the safety issues and things like that. They had the big crash at Le Mans and wiped out a bunch of spectators.
I mean, there were some senators and congressmen that actually wanted to ban stock car races.
They wanted to put them, put them out of business.
Too dangerous sport.
So, the factories were getting a lot of pressure from the government as well as the insurance companies to make some changes and do things different. And at the end of 57, well, towards the end of the season in 57, they were at Martinsville, and Daddy and Tiger Tom were racing for the lead. They'd been beating, they'd been racing up front. Daddy had led 250 some laps, and there was 450 laps into the race, and it started raining. And NASCAR didn't throw a caution flag immediately, and they got tangled up on the front straight away. And I told you I found a picture of that wreck, but I never see Tiger Tom's car in the picture, but you could see tire marks on the track that went out and came down across them back across the racetrack. And those were, I'm assuming, were Daddy's tire tracks because they went straight up to the wall between the end of the grandstand on the front straightaway, flagman stand, the caution flag. And that's the luckiest man in the world there because he hit the wall, went up on top of it, and then around all the way down to the scoreboard in turn one. And in the wreck, a chunk of concrete hit a kid who was standing in a restricted area with his dad, and it gave him severe brain damage. And that wreck, I think, was probably the final nail in the coffin that the factory and the factories had to fight against the government and the insurance companies. And so they pulled out of racing at that time. The factories pulled out, and so Daddy was without a ride. He had the car, and they went to Daytona spring of 58 with the car, and maybe ran one more race. And of course, he ran a couple of races for Lee Petty at the time. He drove he won a convertible race at Wilson for Lee at the end of 57, and then he won another convertible race at Wilkesboro in March of 58, about a little less than a month before he died. And but those cars then, he didn't have all the backing that it took to do it, so he was building a car to come back to the stadium and run on a regular basis. And when he came back the first night of the season, his car wasn't competitive, so he got a car belonging to William Mason and started up front and led the majority of the race with about five laps to go. He was leading the race and had a heart attack and pulled off. Car drove off, veered off into the bushes over there off turn four, and he died there. And George Dunn went on to win the race. And ironically, I guess Mother sold the car to George Dunn. The Mercury sold to George Dunn, and Manly Britt and Mac Howard. And you remember Mac? He worked for Ned Jarrett.
Yeah. Now, listen, owner of the Mercury, this Bill Strop Mercury, but sometime, didn't it say George Dunn was owner of that car?
In 58, not in 57.
Okay.
In '58. You could have.
I remember seeing that.
George went to the first race at Daytona with that car in '59. That car ran as a convertible.
Well, I'm going back to '56 and '57. It listed somebody else's name.
There was, it wasn't George. That's what we were talking about earlier. That when it was number 14, it always listed that Strop as the owner, and when it was number four. It listed another fellow, but it wasn't George. But
I wasn't sure who that was. Yeah, I wonder if it was a Mercury guy.
I don't know why. I mean, it could have been somebody that was involved with a Mercury dealership or something like that. I really don't know. And of course, Bob's gone, and the only one left is Uncle Frank, and he doesn't know. Yeah. So we just.
Well, you stayed racing all these years, and after his death, you probably went away, but you come back.
I did. Well, we stayed around the stadium for a long time, but they started the memorial race in I guess '60. They died in '57, '58, and I think they did the first memorial race in '60. And they did that for several years, but after that, I ran my first race at the stadium in the year I graduated high school in '65, and I think I ran a race over there in '65 or '66, or the claiming race, and then I followed Gary around for a while, but I never was really that dedicated to racing him like Gary was, my brother, and he's the one that really made that happen. So a lot of stuff that I did later, was because of him having a car. I'd drive his backup car, had a sportsman car, and ran a little bit, but I stayed away from the stadium for several years, and then when Gary decided he couldn't afford to run the Grand National stuff anymore, we came back to the stadium and started running modifieds, and they've been there ever since. So that was, I guess, in 79 or so, something like that. Keep driving away from over there now. So.
Randy, what I often wondered, I like the old stuff, right?
Sure. Oh, yeah.
I grew up in that period of time. If you could turn the pages back, and all of a sudden, 1949, 50, 51, 2, 3, 4. If you could go to Bowling Green Stadium this Saturday night, Bobby, Billy Myers, Perk Brown, Ted Swain, Curtis Turner, Fonnie Flock, Glenn Wood, Whitey Norman, Ken Rush, what do you think would happen?
They would probably have to put sideboards on the place. You remember, if you go to Thanksgiving dinner and Grandma gives you a big plate and you pile it up and it runs over. So you want to put sideboards on that plate, that's what they'd have to do over there. You couldn't put the people in the place.
You wouldn't have to stage nothing.
No, it's
but you're going to bring Ken Rush there. You're going to have a fight, right? they get to see it all.
A few years later, you get Max and some other folks in there. It was the stadium, like we said earlier, it's a unique place. It's a track unto itself. Or a world into itself, in a racing world, and it is what it is. And I finally it took me a long time to accept it for what it was. I was for a long time one of those guys that said, well, it's not fair that they get everything and nobody else does, so let's do something else. But the stadium is it's the core. It's what started it in this area. Although your dad's track and others were here, the stadium was the first place that it was a paved place. It had lights up, and the guy could go for 80 cents, I think, the first year that they were there, 50, 60 cents the first year, and be right on top of the action and see what went on all the time. And it's just a throwback.
And look at the families. The generations, they sat in the same section, same seats
Absolutely.
That they sat there 50 years ago, didn't they?
Absolutely.
Can you believe that?
It's amazing. It's like I said, I sold people soda pop, but if they're not dead, I could probably sell them one the first Saturday night to see the season next year. And, it's the core to what evolved into modified racing in the South because, over the years, NASCAR finally decided to let the modifieds gravitate north and the fendered cars come south. And it just, it is what it is. It's a great place to go. It's not really the family place that some folks say it is, but it's a place you can take your family and still have a good time.
Yeah, you can get up and leave after the race.
Sure,
you can watch
leave,
the race.
That's right.
But it is a great show. Okay.
And that show being the key word. And, you know, we've got to get a little bit off topic, but the modifieds in the South, NASCAR has a tour, and they have, it's really become a northern tour with a few southern cars in it. And if you look at the attendance at the other racetracks in the area, like Caraway and places like that, where the modifieds go a lot, they're not drawing any people to the modified races because there's no people. The stadium fans don't relate to the,
that's right.
The northern guys, and so they don't go. And you know, it makes a lot of difference is what's going on. So you know, maybe it'll evolve and come back full circle. But you know, we just got to see what happens there.
Well, like always, Randy, I enjoyed talking about the old time. I appreciate you coming over and doing it.
We'll have to go look. You was talking about those 56 markers a while ago. We'll have to go to that junkyard up on 49 so we can't find them. So.
Well, thanks a bunch for coming over.
I appreciate
it. Certainly enjoy it.
Thank you, man.
No four running on a red dirt road. The stars are bright and the moon is low. Coming up behind, bet he thinks he's gonna catch me with this load of moonshine. But I cut the lights and